The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 15. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, how's everyone doing tonight? Thank you for being here. I think there's a football game on, but we're going to get into this. So guys, reminder, we've set up the Rebel Capitalist Show podcast. So those of you who are interested or like the audio, the podcast, I know that's what I do whenever I go to the gym or I'm just out at lunch or whatever, is always listening to podcasts like Macro Voices. So what we do is we take the audio from the interviews that I do and the in these live streams, and we just clean them up a little bit and we put them on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes or Stitcher or any of those podcast resources and you type in the Rebel Capitalist Show, you can go ahead and subscribe, and you can take the Rebel Capitalist Show wherever you go, audio format. Okay, question, thoughts on China losing pigs and chicken, now bad human virus. Well, I'm not sure. Well, let me say this. I've been doing some research today for other videos that I'm going to do this week. And one thing that's always stayed consistent throughout human history is food prices are correlated, strongly so, to social unrest. And inflation is in general, but it's really, really strong when it comes to food prices. So if that stokes food prices, and I've heard a lot of rumors that there's some serious stagflation going on in China. I'm not going to say I would assume there's going to be social unrest in China, but there's a much better chance of that, including everything that's going on in Hong Kong, if they start to have their food prices increase substantially, which, by the way, that we in the United States will most likely have because of this trade deal. You know, Trump, and I think I addressed that on the video Friday, that although this phase one, whatever you want to call it, that involves China buying a lot of food and energy, well, there's not going to be much more supply made. So that means that your food and energy costs will most likely go up. So I'm not quite sure on net balance if that's a good thing. Matt, thank you for the super chat. He says, do you use Morris Invest HELOC strategy to pay off? I'm not sure who Morris Invest is. I think that's a gentleman with a real estate investing YouTube channel, but I'm not sure, and I don't know his specific strategy, Matt. So I can tell you that I do use a line of credit on my properties in the United States that I have 100% equity that I just paid for in cash. And I do that so I've got that equity always at my fingertips. So if I get let me give you a specific example. When I did a remodel project outside of the United States, I just used my line of credit on some of the properties that I had in the US, and I did the entire project from start to finish. I made in the six figures on the project, and I didn't have a penny out of pocket because I just leveraged that equity through that line of credit. And then as soon as I got done with the project, I sold it and I went ahead and paid off the line of credit. So you can, if you know what you're doing, and I don't want to say this frivolously because I've had a lot of people comment on a lot of the videos on how dangerous leverage can be in credit. That is absolutely 100% true. And I do not like consumer credit, but if you know what you're doing with real estate, you can use leverage to your advantage. So my point is I have used line of credits on my equity, and I think they're a good thing if you know what you're doing. Okay, Andrew, thanks for the super chat. What are your thoughts on buying long volatility, timing determined by technical analysis? Well, volatility is cheap right now, that is for sure. See, I'm not much of a trader, Andrew, so I apologize, but if my memory serves me well, I think there's a carrying cost to go long volatility because you'd have to do it through, I don't know if it's a volatility ETF, or I know there's some sort of financial product that they offer where you can go long volatility. But I think there might be a carrying cost to that. My concern would be if you have to wait for a year or two for the trade to pay off, then is your gain going to be kind of wiped out by your carrying costs? It's so tough to time that, as opposed to going long uranium, which is also very cheap. If that doesn't pan out for 2 or 3 years, most likely you won't have the carrying costs there. And hopefully you could find a uranium play that pays a dividend. I haven't looked into it, so I don't know, but that would be ideal. I know the amount of uranium companies have decreased dramatically, according to Rick Rule. I did a video on that the other day, but that's kind of what I would prefer if I was going to take a flyer as a speculation on something that's cheap right now. And just so you guys know, I'm super, super stoked about this. I'm doing an interview with Rick Rule, the legend himself, this Friday. So I'm not sure when we're going to post that onto the channel, but I emailed him last week. He had his assistant email me back. We set it up. So super, super stoked about that. Rick Rule interview this Friday. And Matt asks, do you use realtors? How do you find your houses? I use realtors on the sell side, Matt. I don't use them. Well, I shouldn't say that. I have used them on the buy side in the past, but I don't do it that often, especially not in Colombia, because in Colombia, you got to do the boots on the ground research yourself to get the really good deals. And you're always making money on the buy side, not the sell side. So it's just so crucial that you understand that component and you do it well. So long story short, I use them on the sell side, but not so much on the buy side. Adalberto, thank you for the super chat, my friend, says, timing the housing market. I want to buy property in the cyclical market, Chicago, Texas, rising advice. My advice is don't time the market. Oh, sorry, buddy. I hate to rain on your parade, but my advice is don't do what you're trying to do. But let me go ahead and answer the question to the best of my ability. If you're trying to time that cyclical market, you've got to look at the inflation adjusted average home price for that market going as far back as you possibly can. So if you can get it going back to at least 1980 when interest rates started, or 81 when they started to go down, that'll help you a little bit. And then you just have to look at, and then compare the inflation adjusted prices to where they were in 2006. And if we're where we were in 2006, okay, well, now's not the time to buy. It's expensive. So to roll the dice on a cyclical play, you've got to buy at the bottom. And I can promise you there are no cyclical markets right now in the United States or in the world for that matter that are at the bottom or cheap for that matter. So I'd start looking at a average home price in that area adjusted for inflation going as far back as I could. And then just look at the price to income ratios as well. And then the proof is going to be in the pudding when you look at the RV ratios. Even in the cyclical markets, if the RV ratios are high, then the home prices most likely aren't going to be cheap. So, and then Chicago, I know Jason likes that. Well, I'm not going to say he likes it. He's okay with Chicago for a variety of reasons. But yeah, I personally don't like Chicago for the reason that you mentioned, the taxes rising. You got it. It looks like, and just FYI, guys, everyone who's into real estate or just considering a housing purchase, I think that the way these states that have massive holes in their pension funding, like Illinois, like California, the direction they're going to go to, or one of the directions they're going to go to try to fill that gap, is going to be raising property taxes. So just kind of buyer beware. ROI company, thank you for the super chat. Is a 30-year fixed rate mortgage really a good idea? German currency reset 1948 had worse conversion rate for debt than regular money. I'm not sure I fully follow the question. Is a 30-year fixed rate mortgage really a good idea? At least in the United States, I think it is, but I'm not sure if you can get a 30-year fixed rate outside the U.S. under the same conditions. Yeah, I'd have to look into that. But as far as the 30-year fixed rate mortgages that I know of and how they work in the United States, I definitely think it's a good idea. That said, I don't know if they work differently in other countries because I don't have any experience there. Okay, Paul, thank you for the super chat. Asks, what's your thoughts on buying an ETF with treasury underlyings? I don't know why you just wouldn't buy the treasury. I mean, with an ETF, you're going to have to pay a fee to the person who's putting together that ETF. Although it's not much, but why pay it when you could just go to the treasury and buy them yourself? That's what I would do. Okay, Braun, 01US, thank you for the super chat. The trailing stop for buy on inverse S&P, I think is your question, ETF. Last stop for, no. I mean, if you're going to go long anything in the market, you definitely want a trailing loss. That is for sure. I'm just hesitant because I just don't like being long the market because it's just so wildly overpriced and you're really just gambling. But if you're doing this with the portion of your portfolio that's exclusively allocated to speculation, maybe. I mean, but again, with speculation, it's like buying things that are cheap. And there's just nothing cheap about the market. Unless you've got like a hedge strategy where you've got short positions and you're trying to hedge it with buying the S&P, in which case I understand that, but that's a little more advanced. But regardless, I would definitely suggest using a trailing stop for sure. Okay, the High Viz Economist. Seeing him in the chat again. Thank you very much for your continued support. We've got another super chat. I'm using ETF, looks like the VIX. Okay, double leverage, ongoing long VIX, long volatility. It's really dangerous. Okay, I'm glad you know that. But I'm in it. It decays rapidly. Yeah, I think that's kind of the carrying cost that I was thinking of. Just trying to time the market like you tell it. Oh, I don't tell you to time the market. What are you talking? Oh, joking. Okay. if you guys can't see the comment, it says, just trying to time the market like you tell us to, George. And then it says, joking, LOL. So, yeah, okay, I was about to say, whoa, time out. Yeah. All right. Carlos Danger, thank you for the super chat. Jason Hartman listed several areas on his website good for investment property besides KC, Kansas City. What other areas are you interested in? Me personally, I'm not, because I'm not a buyer right now in the United States because I already have 50% of my portfolio allocated to USD assets. And I spend most of my time outside the United States, so my expenses aren't denominated in dollars. So I'm not looking to buy more. Now, if I had 100% of my portfolio in the United States, then I would. And then I'd have to decide as to whether or not I want to diversify outside of Kansas City. For me, there's a lot of downside to that because I have such a strong infrastructure and team, as Jason says, in the Kansas City area that I've worked really hard to build. So I don't know if I'd want to try to attempt that outside of KC when I've already put in all the work there. Although I do see benefits to diversifying your portfolio to where you're in multiple linear markets. So I think it depends on how much I wanted to put to work. Like if I just wanted to put like a couple hundred grand to work, just buy a couple properties, or I'd probably stick with Kansas City. If I wanted to put another million to work and buy 7 or 8 properties, then I'd probably do a couple KC and I'd spread it around a bit. But as far as the specific markets where I would spread them, I don't know because I haven't done the research, but I would definitely start by asking Jason. That would be my first phone call for sure. And if you don't have his phone number, then I would go to his website because those are the, trust me, I mean, Jason's a good buddy, but he's going to tell you, or he would tell me the exact same thing that he would tell you. And he wouldn't, anything that he's going to tell me is going to be listed on his website. That's what I'm trying to say. So he's very transparent and he's all about doing what is best for the investor. Hector, thank you for the super chat. says, you are big on real estate as a hedge against inflation and rates and rising rates. But for someone who doesn't want to mess with the logistics, are equity-focused REITs a valid alternative? Nah, I mean, I kind of see them as apples and oranges, Hector, because you're buying a... Oh, there's so many things that can go wrong with a REIT, such as they're a lot more tied to the dynamics of the overall stock market than just a single family rental home would be. You've got management issues. They're taking a cut of the action. I'm not saying don't go into REITs, but I think what I am saying is I don't know that I would consider them a substitute or an alternative for a rental property that you control 100% of, just because I think it's apples and oranges. So I think that's the best way that I can describe it. Shad, thank you very much for the super chat. Shad says, what is your informal prediction for when the equity market will finally take a dump? And what do you think will be the final ultimate trigger? And yes, I know it's speculation, just curious. I would say look at interest rates. Going back when I did that video of Druckenmiller, he made an exceptional point that I hadn't thought of. And he said that he, in his career, he hadn't seen the market crash without the Fed in a tightening cycle. And I went back and looked, and sure enough, he's right on the money. So I'm not saying that the market can't crash when the Fed is in an easing mode, but it's a lot less likely. So for me, I would look for the Fed reversing their monetary policy, meaning tightening interest rates, or the repo market, QE4. I mean, any of these things, you guys know the laundry list of monetary easing that they're doing right now. So I would look for that to reverse course. So if they start doing QT again, if they back out of the repo market, that's just not even possible. But the bottom line is once they start tightening interest rates or tightening monetary policy, that is when I would potentially speculate on the market going down. Lee Campbell, thank you, Lee, for the super chat, asks, have learned more from your videos than my econ professor in college. Okay. I don't know. That's kind of a sad thing to say, but yeah, unfortunately, I guess that's reality nowadays. You can learn a lot more on YouTube than you can with a $100,000 college degree. Curious as to what made you choose Colombia other than other South American countries. Do you have citizenship? What made you want to live there? Well, to be clear, I don't really, if someone asks me where I live, I don't really have a good answer to that, because I'm not, I know it sounds weird, but I just, I don't like staying rooted to one place. Now, that doesn't mean that I won't be in Colombia for the next year, 2 years, 5 years, but I'm not married to it. If I feel like going to Croatia for a year in 3 months, then that's what I'm going to do. So I don't know that I really live here, but I have spent the last year here. And so let me get to the heart of your question. And that's, why do I like Colombia? Well, I started coming here in 2015, or investing here, because the peso was super cheap, because oil was cheap, and the peso is correlated to oil. So I wanted a long play on oil, but I don't know anything about oil. I know a lot about real estate. So I figured if I bought an asset that I know a lot about denominated in pesos, it would basically be the same as going long oil. That was my mentality. That was my thought process. So I came here and bought the peso at 3,400, which I haven't really made much money on the exchange. But I figured that if I come in and do a forced appreciation, which means you buy an old property, just your typical rehab, and you build equity, then that equity build would compensate for my potential downside for the currency going against me if oil would have continued to go down. And then if oil went up and I had a pop on the currency, then in dollar terms, I'd have a double whammy, because I'd make money on the currency, and then I'd make money on the forced appreciation, or that equity build to the rehab and the sale. So that was the game plan. And as it turned out, I haven't made much money on the currency, although I've made a bit, At a point in time, I'd made quite a bit, but then it went against me again. But I've made a ton of money on the real estate and doing the remodels. So now I've got my whole team here from Ecuador, brought them here in 2015. Angie and Joaquin, if you guys haven't watched any of the vlogs on the channel that we still have, you'll, I'm sure, see Angie and Joaquin on there. I work with them constantly. They're the ones that manage that, I guess, business, if you want to call it that, for me. And so that's why I stayed here. But outside of that, it's gorgeous. It's an amazing place to spend time. I've been to over 40 countries, and this is one of my favorites, if not my favorite. It's just the weather's perfect. The food's amazing. The people are amazing. The cost of living is dirt cheap. It's just, it's a 3-hour flight from Miami. It's, there's just what's not to like. So, you know what I always tell people? I say, listen, if there was a state, let's say you live in New York, and I said to you, you know what? There's this state that you've never heard about where the people are amazing. The weather is better than San Diego, and the cost of living is a fraction of what it would be to live in the middle of Mississippi or some super cheap state, and the food is amazing. It's organic. Your quality of life is 10 times better. Your standard of living is better. Your purchasing power is 10 times, for New York, it's 100 times more than you have in New York. Wouldn't you want to move to that state? Like immediately. So just because it's not a state, it's from New York, it's probably the same as flying to California or flying to Washington. So really, who cares? It's, and I know that I'm kind of unique in the sense that I don't really look at borders the way most people do. To me, they're just arbitrary lines in the sand that they just don't mean anything. Maybe they used to, but to me, they really don't anymore. So whether I'm in this pile of sand or this pile of sand over here, it doesn't really matter to me. I'd rather go where I'm treated best, like Andrew Henderson says with the Nomad Capitalist, and where my capital is treated best and where I have more personal freedom and liberty than really being held hostage to just a arbitrary line in the sand. So anyway, I kind of went off on a tangent there. I'll get back to the super chats. Hopefully that answered your question, Lee. Oh, and I'm looking at your question further. I do not have citizenship. Sebastian set me up with an investor visa the other day, which will allow me to get my citizenship. In other words, have two passports in it's either 3 years or 5 years. I'm not sure, but Sebastian put me on that path. So when the time comes, I'll be ready to pull the trigger. Victor, thank you for the super chat, asks, do you think precious metal confiscation might be a possibility in a crash scenario? What measures could be taken to avoid this? Is a gold IRA a safe alternative? Okay, let me answer this. So yes, I do think it could be a possibility. And I don't know if you saw my video on that, Victor. I checked that out. I think I did that last week or the week prior. And in doing the research, I found it kind of scary that the three main Western countries, that have confiscated gold in the past have been the UK, the United States, and Australia, the countries that we see as being stable. So there's precedence for that in the past, and I don't like that. That makes me nervous. So definitely, now I don't know what the probabilities are, but it's definitely a possibility. I think you need to determine the probabilities on your own. What measures could be taken to avoid this? You diversify. So you have some gold in different political jurisdictions. And that's why I always say that the third rule of my investment strategy is to diversify your portfolio, but also diversify your currency risk and your political risk. I think that's, and then also Mike Maloney has a really good video on this where he talked about buying jewelry. That's like, they have companies, I think actually Mike might have a company that does this, but I think Schiff has a company that does this as well, where they design and make jewelry with the maximum amount of pure gold possible. And Mike made a great point that in his research, he had never found a country that confiscated the jewelry. They only confiscated the gold bars, and so necklaces, rings, bracelets, they never confiscated that. And I thought that was really, really interesting. So if you had 50 grand or 100 grand and you really, really, really want an insurance policy and you're worried about that, it might be good just to get a Mr. T necklace that you could just throw on and take the next flight to Medellin and not have to worry about it. But I think that's the best advice that I could give you. As far as a gold IRA, a safe alternative, I don't think so. Okay, Siavash asks, what do I do with my IRA 401k? Recommend gold IRA. Boy, I'm not sure how the IRAs and 401ks work because I don't have one. I've never owned or I've never had one. I know if you've got a self-directed IRA, that gives you a lot of latitude that you might not otherwise have. So I don't know how you could own gold in that, but I would set up my IRA just like I set up my portfolio, and that I'd have 10% allocated to insurance, by 10% allocated to speculation, and the other 80% of it I would have in something that pays me to own it, whether that's a super cheap like foreign stock with a great dividend or a rental property in Kansas City. I don't think the vehicle in which I use to invest would really change my investment strategy at all. Air Mail Deal, thank you for the super chat. George, how do you generally manage maintenance, legal, tax, etc., your real estate remotely? Do you have a local management company or subcontract or what? Yeah, I've got a local property management company that just handles it. As far as the legal, you're not going to have much legal with a rental property. Taxes, I just pay the property taxes online. Where I invest in Jackson County, Missouri, it's pretty user-friendly. You just log onto their website. You just click your properties, give them your credit card or your bank account number, and they just auto-debit it. Takes 15, 20 minutes at the most once a year. So the big issues that you have, to your point, are maintenance and collecting rent. And for that, I just outsource that to my property management company. Okay, David asks, thank you for the super chat, David. As a European, is there any way of investing in the U.S. in U.S. real estate and getting similar ROI, maybe through an LLC? Can companies get 30-year fixed rate? I want to avoid REITs and European real estate. Well, I don't blame you, David. I think that's a smart decision. And they want Europeans or foreigners can 100% buy U.S. real estate, and they can get mortgages. I don't know that they even have to do it through an LLC. I think you might even be able to just do it personally, but you could do it through an LLC. And what I would do with that is I would go to Jason's website and just ask one of his investment counselors. You don't have to commit to buying through them, or it's free. I would just call him up and just kind of ask those questions, because I would guess maybe 10, even more than that, I would say probably north of 20% of Jason's clients are outside of the United States. So they're going to have those questions for you just right in order. They'll just rattle that right off the top of their head. But I know for a fact that number one, you can own. Number two, you can have an LLC. And number three, you can get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Hector, thanks for the super chat. Hector asks, you advocate buying low and selling high. I can't find good value now. Yeah, I know. Whether real estate, stocks, bonds, etc., would you hold up in cash until the next crash, even if that takes a few years? I'd diversify, Hector. And keep in mind, when you're looking at real estate, I understand that the prices are not even close to cheap. I get that. But try not to look at real estate from the standpoint of the price or the market price of the actual asset itself, because you're really buying the cash flow. So if you can get good, cheap cash flow, and keep in mind, if you're buying that with 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that is cheap. That is super cheap. That is the only USD denominated asset, if you want to look at it like that, which I do, that is cheap right now. So you're buying, or you're taking control of a cheap mortgage that you're going to make money on through inflation. You're going to get paid to short the dollar, and you're going to get cheap, most likely. If you buy right, you're going to get cheap cash flow. And then the asset itself that's yielding that isn't necessarily cheap. For that, you just want to buy an asset with as little downside as possible. So if you can buy under the cost of construction in one of these great neighborhoods in a linear market, I think that's your best option. Other than potentially looking at stocks, if you're good at that, and I want to preface with, I wouldn't suggest that for everyone, but if you understand how to analyze a balance sheet and a P&L, and you're comfortable with that, you're professional, then I think there could be a lot of opportunity outside the United States in dividend paying stocks. But as far as cash, so going back to my original point, you want to say, okay, for me personally, I want to compartmentalize. I want insurance, I want investments, that's things that pay me to own them, and I want a portion of that for speculation. Now those percentages differ with everybody, but then you'd also want a portion of the total pie in cash to take advantage of a potential downturn. And for that, I would suggest using just T-bills and rolling them over. And I know I had someone the other day say that his broker was charging him such an extreme commission for that, that it was wiping out the rate of interest. But I think you can go directly to the government and buy them, and you don't have to deal with the broker. 179 Kevin, thank you for the super chat. George, do you see a global economic crisis looming and digital currency rising from the ashes? Well, I see the possibility of a global economic crisis increasing daily. That's not to say that it's 100%, but if you look at what dynamics cause a crisis, mainly unsustainable debt, it's getting worse every single day. So we're a lot closer to a crash now than we were yesterday. and then we were 5 years ago, especially if we get interest rates going the other direction and we go through an up cycle of 20, 30 years in rates. And I know most people say, oh, that's impossible. It's impossible. Well, that's when everyone's on the wrong side of the boat, right? So as far as a digital currency, I don't know if you're referring to a crypto, like a Bitcoin. I think that a lot of people will try to find solace in a digital currency like they're doing in Venezuela. But I don't know that that will be how we'll transact, because in its current iteration, Bitcoin, I don't know if it could handle billions of transactions per second would be required for like a world digital currency. That said, I do think that there'll be a government-backed digital currency, but I think we're going to have a government-backed digital currency regardless of whether or not we have a crash in the market. That's coming. That's in my opinion, it's a foregone conclusion. It's not a if question, it's a when question. Patrick, thank you for the super chat. Says 4-week treasuries have a yield of 1.5. Okay, cool. Which works out, let's see, Patrick, let me read your question. And then I'm not sure that you're seeing this correctly, but let me read it first. 4-week treasuries have a yield of 1.52%, an annual compounded interest is over 12 months, which would work out to be 19% year over year. In what scenario can this be deemed a risky investment? Yeah, okay, so just be clear, Patrick. When they say a 6-month treasury or a 4-week treasury or a 3-month treasury is yielding 1.5%, that's annualized. That's not the rate of interest that you're getting per time frame. So that's the annual interest that you're getting. So you would only, if you had a 3-month treasury, you would only get a pro rata amount of that 1.5%. That's not the interest rate for that particular maturity that you're buying. So I think that kind of answers your question there. Okay, question. Do you think US has 8,000 tons of gold? That's a great question. I haven't really looked into that too much. There's guys that I respect on both sides of that argument. I think the best way I can answer that question is I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. Just because, I mean, you just can't trust the government. You're going to be right far more often if you assume the government is lying to you and the politicians are lying to you. So I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. I think that's the best answer I can give you. What happened to Zoltan Pozsar predicting repo market? Was it all wrong? I don't think it was all wrong, because I don't think it turned out to be as bad as he thought, but I don't think he was wrong, because if you look at what happened, as soon as he came out with that report, I think it was on December 9th, like December 12th, the Fed just did a total 180. And if you look at their website on December 12th, they committed to a lot more, providing a lot more liquidity for that year end turn. If that's the way the financial guys say end of the year. So I think the Fed definitely read his report and they said, wait a minute here, what are we not seeing? And then they took his advice and they went ahead and provided a heck of a lot more liquidity than they were planning, and that acted as a buffer. Now, the market didn't absorb as much liquidity as the Fed was willing to commit to. So in that way, I think Zoltan might have been wrong in the sense that he might have assumed the market would need more liquidity than they really did. But the market did need more liquidity, and the Fed was not prepared. Like always, they're behind the curve. So he was right from that standpoint. AF Visions, thank you for the super chat, asks, if you were buying your first single family home to live in, okay, in Austin with 30-year mortgage, what would be your biggest concern? Increased property taxes would definitely be a concern for me, for sure. You know, another thing that would be a concern, and I hate to say this, but you've got so many people moving to Austin, especially from Texas, or excuse me, from California, that they don't learn. They vote these knuckleheads in California that completely destroy the entire state, and then they go to a different state and they vote for the same type of knuckleheads. So although that would take a long time to play out, but if it's the house you're going to live in, I would look at the RV ratios. If you have a low RV ratio, I would rent. I don't know why you would buy there. I would just take that equity or that down payment, and I would buy rental properties in markets that had good RV ratios. Because if you do that math, and I have a video where I go through that, I think it's the rent to buy video, you're going to see that over the long run, 20, 30 years, you make way more money by owning rental properties that in markets with a high RV ratio and renting a residence in a market with a low RV ratio. And I know it sounds kind of bizarre, but it's definitely true. So that's what I would do. Now, I understand that I don't have a wife, I don't have kids. I can make decisions strictly based on the numbers, and most people don't have that luxury. So if you had to buy there for a house, then yeah, that it'd be political, just moving the goalposts on the property taxes and potentially the income taxes. Those would be my biggest concerns. And it's not cheap. And it's not cheap because if you're not buying the cash flow, then you are buying the price. And so that would be my concern too. That the market is really expensive, the high taxes and the political stuff. Daniel, thank you for the super chat, asks, Bitcoin can handle at most four transactions per second. Yeah, I know. Well, I didn't know that exactly, but I know it's not enough. Ethereum is around 22. Visa handles 2,000 per second. Yeah. Any crypto solution that can handle high transactions will be centralized. Unfortunately, in their current iteration. Now, I'm optimistic. I want to be optimistic, and I know there's so many smart people that are working on this. I'd like to think that in a year or two, maybe they can solve that problem without having to centralize it. But yeah, in its current iteration, to your point, Daniel, I just don't see Bitcoin being a transactional solution. I think it's well, you know, I did that interview with my buddy Andrew. He's a really good guy in Australia who's a Bitcoin expert. And what he suggests doing is you have your Satoshi wallet, and you just keep your spending money, your transactional purchasing power in that Satoshi wallet, maybe $300-$400 at the most. And then you just keep your Bitcoin, which isn't necessarily transactional, on your USB drive or wherever you like to keep it. Let's say you got $100,000 on your USB drive, then you keep that, and then just every time you need an extra, it's like going to the ATM machine. Every single time you need to go to the ATM, you just transfer it from your decentralized or private USB, and then to your Satoshi wallet, as an example. I'm not just saying that's the only one to use. And then that would make it more of a user-friendly experience from a transactional standpoint. Maybe that's a solution. I'm not sure. I'm definitely going to have Andrew on again. So, you know, I'm sure we'll discuss that. Joel, thank you for the super chat, asks, a lot of folks here seem to be wondering what to do with their paper money trapped in IRAs. I know. What do you think about REITs? I mean, if my only option was to buy something in the market, I try to do that self-directing and buy some rental properties. But assuming that I could not do that, that was impossible. Yeah, I'd maybe consider REITs, but I'd diversify. There's no way I'd take 100% of my portfolio and do that. I'd allocate maybe 10 or 20% at the most. It's very difficult for me to answer because you're just between a rock and a hard place. And unfortunately, I wish I had a silver bullet for you. Just wave the magic wand and boom, do this. This is the secret that no one's heard of before and that only I have and that I can give you guys to handle this problem. But I don't have that silver bullet, so I apologize. But I'm constantly looking, constantly trying to figure this out. So hopefully between the whole community here, within we can figure out at least the best approach when all your options are bad. Conrad, thank you for the super chat, asks, when California housing pops, the bubble pops, will loans still be available? Housing prices drop, but will rates rise, voiding the house cost price savings? You are the best. Thank you, Conrad. I appreciate that. I'm just trying to think through your question. So on a macro level, you're right. When the bubble bursts, ironically, that's the hardest time to get leverage. And it's what pisses me off about banks is they're more than willing to lend when they shouldn't be lending, when we're at the top of a bubble. And when you should be buying, when there's blood in the streets, then banks won't lend to anybody. That tells you how, I don't want to throw them all under the bus, but that I think they're mostly like that. But if you have a really strong relationship with a small bank, then I think you can get around that. So as an example, I'm really good buddies with the vice president of commercial lending for the bank that I use in Kansas City. He's a really smart dude, great guy. And I've used them for so long, and we've done so many deals together, and they've made a lot of money on me, and I've made a lot of money on them. So I don't know for a fact but I'm pretty confident that if the market, the housing market, were to crash like it did in 2009, that I could go to my buddy and he would still give me a loan because he has that much confidence in my ability to make money and to pay back that loan with interest. And but that was a relationship that I had to build. So my best advice to you is right now, when we're in the good times from a lending standpoint, start building that relationship with your community bank if possible. And then you'll be able to lean on that relationship when the housing prices crash, if they do, and when no one else can get a loan, you'll be able to get one. And that will give you even more of an advantage and an edge over your competition. Okay, Hector, thank you for the super chat. I know you can outsource rental property management to a real estate agent, but are there companies to outsource it, actually property hunting, buying? Well, again, my team in Kansas City, Christina, I did a whole interview with her that you guys can watch, and that's what she'll do for me. I do not have to be in Kansas City to, not that I'm buying now, but if I was, I would not have to be there. Like, Christina could handle it from A to Z. I would have 100% confidence that she could do that, and we could get the whole thing done, and I'd be making a good decision because I'd use the same inspector. And Steve and Christina, they're a husband and wife team that I use. Steve always goes to the properties. He does like a 15-minute video of everything that could go wrong with the property. He does video of the foundation, of the roof. He crawls up in the attic. He does everything. So I can see it remotely just like I'm there. And if I have that video, in addition to the inspection report, I'm totally confident throwing down $150,000 without seeing the property. But I'm not saying you should do that unless you've got that team set up that you've worked with and you really, really trust. You got to trust them. And now, that said, any of you are more than able to use Christina if you'd like to. She's definitely at your disposal. And I think at the end of that video, she actually gives you her cell phone number. So you guys can just call her, text her, or whatever. But that's really my point is if you have the team, then yes, it's possible. If you don't, then don't even try it. No way. And also, too, one thing that Jason and I haven't talked about is a lot of these turnkey operators, you don't want to deal with them because you got to ask them, okay, why are they selling these turnkey properties to these outside investors instead of just flipping them right on the MLS? The reason is because they can sell a cap rate and dupe these outside investors to buy a property that's, let's say, in the ghetto, that anyone local who is looking just on the MLS, like an owner occupant, they wouldn't pay that price. So on the MLS, they might be able to get $100,000 for the property. We're selling it to a California real estate investor that doesn't know the difference. You know, some doctor or some dentist in California who sees a property for $120,000 and a 6% net return on their investment, cash on cash. And they're like, yeah, wow, that's amazing compared to California. But they don't realize that's not a $120,000 property. That's a $100,000 property. And that's why most of the turnkey operators are turnkey operators. So you got, and I'm not saying all of them are like that. Don't get me wrong, but a lot of them are. So you've really got to be careful. Okay, so I've got that question from Hector. Okay, next question. Thank you very, I'm not sure the name. Thank you very much. It says, you are great. Put this with your $1 million. thank you very much. I appreciate it. I need to be clear on this, guys. I did retire when I was in 2012. I was 38 years old. I was a self-made millionaire at the age of 34. I had no help with that. But that doesn't mean that every business that I started or went into made money. I had a lot of failures. It's just I was fortunate in the sense that I had more winners than losers, if you want to look at it like that. But I don't want anyone to think that I'm some sort of entrepreneurial super genius and that every single thing that I touched just magically turned to gold. That was not the way it was. I failed many, many times. It's just through those failures, I was able to learn what not to do. And in the end, like I said, I had more winners than losers. Okay, Aurora Borealis asks, George, what do you think about real estate in New York City? Seems like that city never gets cheaper. Would you invest? 1,000,000%, no way would I invest. And if you look at the statistics, and my buddy Jason with Wall Street for Main Street, I think he did a live stream on this the other day. He had some great information. And I saw a guy on Twitter that I follow too, did a post on this, where 50% of the condos built in New York City since like 2013 are empty, completely empty. And that these people are just paying the carrying costs and just they don't even have them rented. And so just think about how much money you're losing and how much it would need to appreciate to compensate for all the property taxes and everything else that goes along with it. So no, I would not buy in New York City. It's, and again, you're looking at this the wrong way. And I don't want to be too harsh here, but I really want to encourage everybody to look at an investment by asking the question. First question you ask is it cheap? That's it. It boggles my mind how many people never ask that question ever. That's not even the 10th question they ask, or they just never ask that question. The first and only question they ask themselves is, do I think the price is going up? That's not the right question to ask. No, don't ask that question. And if you do, it should be way on down the line. The first question is it cheap or is it expensive? Because it just goes back to the simplest thing that we learn in first grade. You buy low, sell high. That's it. Buy low, sell high. You don't buy high and try to sell higher. That's a fool game. And if you continue to do that over the long run, you're just, although you can have winners, don't get me wrong, you absolutely can have winners. Just like if you have a 19 in blackjack and you hit on that 19, like I always say, yes, there is a possibility you get 21. But if you do that over and over and over again, you're going to go bust. So that's the best advice I can give there. Hanzik, real estate in Australia is overvalued. It sure is. And we don't have 30-year fixed rate loans. Where could I put my money that pays me to own it is cheap and not a speculation? Well, I would look into dividend paying stocks. I'm guessing there's probably not many in Australia that are cheap because your guys' interest rates, I know, are very low as well. But maybe you could go up to Asia. I mean, that's the great thing about Australians is they're not like Americans in the sense that Americans just see the world as America. Like, that's it. It's America-centric. Where Aussies, and by the way, I don't know if, Hans, if you know this, but I lived in Australia. I lived in Surfers Paradise in the Gold Coast back in, I think, 2012 or so. But Aussies just don't have that mentality. They're always traveling. I mean, you know this. But so I think that Aussies are much more receptive to investing in a stock market in outside of Australia than Americans are. So you might want to consider that first and foremost. Also, you can definitely buy real estate in the U.S. like we're talking about. But if you're not comfortable with that, I totally get it. I would look at dividend paying stocks that are cheap, maybe in some solid markets outside of Australia, assuming that you can't find that there. But then that said, you definitely want to own some physical gold as well, although Australia's confiscated their gold in the past, or their citizens' gold. I think that was 1959 or so. Actually, it might have been more recent than that. But the reason I say that, Hanzik, is because if you invest in a market outside of Australia, of course, I'm assuming your expenses are denominated in Aussie dollars. So you definitely want to hedge against that currency that you own those stocks in, say that's the Thai baht or something, then that could go against you. And so gold would be a nice hedge there, that if the Thai baht did go against you dramatically, most likely your gold would potentially go up as well. But it might not be directly correlated though. I'm just thinking out loud. So ideally you'd be able to find some nice dividend payers in Australia denominated in Aussie dollars, and then find some outside of Australia as well. So you're really hedged from your currency risk. Ike, thank you very much for the super chat. Could you talk about why you like Croatia? Do you think Eastern Europe, Russia is a good escape, much like Colombia? I'd love to visit Russia. I do, Ike. I'm not too familiar with Russia. I've just been to the airport, so I don't really have too much experience there. But I do have a lot of experience with Croatia, Montenegro specifically, and it's a fantastic place. That whole area is unbelievable. You're right on the sea, the ocean there. The water is crystal clear. It's really like something out of a James Bond movie. It's honestly like that. But the only difference is you get the Monaco type lifestyle at Colombia prices. Like when I was in Montenegro, they just built a yacht club there, and it is. And I've been to the Monaco Grand Prix. And I'm a big Formula One fan, so I've been fortunate to go to quite a few Grand Prix in my day. But I've been to the Monaco Grand Prix, and I can tell you that the vibe in Montenegro around that yacht club is just it's got that Montenegro vibe, but the prices are dirt cheap. Now the real estate is a bit more expensive than Colombia, but the food and all your other living costs are just a fraction of what they would be anywhere else in Europe and in the United States. The people aren't as friendly as the Colombians, but they're really nice. You just got to get to know them a little bit. They're a little abrasive at first glance, but once you warm them up a little bit, they're really awesome people. Really, really amazing. But the water is just crystal clear. It's warm. You've got all the yachts out there and those old wooden speed boats, and it's very glamorous at a very affordable price. So I love it, and I think if you took a trip out there for a week or two just to hang out, I think you'd really like it as well. Everyone that's gone there that I've suggested, hey, you got to check this out. And a few of my buddies have taken the cruise where they go down through Croatia, and every single one of them just comes back and rants and raves on how amazing it is. But they've done the same thing with Colombia. I've had tons of people come down and visit me in Colombia, and quite frankly, quite a few of them were skeptical. But once they got here and once they spent some time here, they every single one of them wants to move here. Everyone, 100%. Jesse, thanks for the super chat, asks, seeing the IMF research papers, specifically negative interest rates, they plan on implementing during next recession paper currency interest rates. I've not seen that specific paper, Jesse, but I think that's the game plan. I think I think Warner's right on that. Professor Richard Warner, if you guys haven't seen his stuff, I don't agree with him on everything, but the guy's smart. And he really knows a lot about the banking system. Definitely someone that you should pay attention to. And he's got a few videos on YouTube where he's been interviewed by the media. And I think he's right in the sense that I think they're going to implement a digital currency, or ban cash, rather. so they can take interest rates negative, and that's going to be their MO for the next recession. It's just you've got to remember, and you've got to put yourself in the mind of a central banker. And I know this is I know it's a scary thought. You don't want to go there for too long, or else you drive yourself crazy. But in their mind, QE works. In their mind, low interest rates worked. And if a country lowered interest, like Japan, if they've been negative for however long, and in the mind of a central banker, they never think that, well, wait a minute. Okay, so maybe negative interest rates don't work. No, that never even occurs to them. Their only thought is, oh, shoot, we just couldn't take them negative enough. It's just there's never a thought that the medicine that they're giving the patient might not work. The only thought is that you didn't give the patient enough medicine. So once you see it from that standpoint, then it's pretty clear what they're going to do. And it's pretty, I don't want to say it's easy, but I think you can kind of see that the most probable end game, if you just try to put yourself in their shoes, where really the only, they just got a hammer. I always use that analogy. And every single problem is just a nail. Just that's all they have is a hammer. So whenever we have a problem, no matter what problem they're trying to fix, it's just going to be money printing, lower interest rates, and QE infinity. And which is ironic too, because if you guys saw my video the other day, when they did QE, at least the Fed, whenever they expand their balance sheet, interest rates on the 10-year actually go up. They went up in the past. The only time they didn't is when they did Operation Twist, and that's when they just sold off short bonds and bought long bonds. So their balance sheet didn't increase, and then interest rates did go down there. But so anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent, but that's really the bottom line. I definitely think that's the path that they're going. And I think it's pretty clear once you kind of try to put yourself into their mindset. Chip, thank you for the super chat, Chip. His question, George, where is data on government pensions? And are you worried about income on your properties if the crash is really hard? Depression-like scenario. So I just Google it, Chip. Whenever I'm looking for data on like the government pensions, if I just Google like pension fund crisis, and then I'd look at like the images and try to find charts, and hopefully they're from reputable sources. That's where I start, and I find most of the most of the research that I do, most of the charts and graphs that I use for the videos, most of them just come from me just doing a quick Google search. Are you worried about the income on your properties crashing really hard? I mean, am I worried? I don't know if I'm worried. It's definitely a concern. I don't lose sleep over it, but it's a possibility. But I think in order for that, because see, I'm not buying properties that are 300 grand, 400 grand, 500 grand lake house that I'm renting out on Airbnb. That's just complete discretionary spending. I'm buying these, or I've purchased in the past, just starter homes. I mean, 150 grand. It's just in a good neighborhood. So under the cost of construction, so people will have to ratchet down, right? And if you look at the last crash that we had, when the market came down by 50%, rents went up because people still needed a place to live, and they couldn't buy anything because there was no credit, and a lot of them lost their jobs, but they still could afford rent. So you had higher demand for rent. That's why they went up. That said, if we go into a long extended depression, whether it's an inflationary depression or normal depression, you're right. You could get downward pressure on rents while there was a lot of downward pressure on prices. because people would change their behavioral patterns, meaning that it would be much more like South America or Europe, where there'd be more people living in a smaller space. But in order for that to happen in the US, we would have to have a crisis for a lot longer than just a couple years. So again, this is up to you to decide for yourself. If you think the most probable outcome is that we're going to go into a Great Depression like we did in the 30s that lasts 10 years, then yeah, there's probably going to be downward pressure on rents. But then again, even if there's downward pressure on rents, you're probably losing less money than you would be losing in all other asset classes, with the exception of cash. So I think the short answer there is it is a concern. It does factor into my thought process, but I don't really lose sleep over it. But, and again, I want to be clear that that's not with all real estate. It's just because I have these starter homes. If I had a $500,000 home on the lake, yeah, I would be super, super worried about that. Okay, Mohit asks, thank you for the super chat, asks, what do you think of EO13772 mentioning Ripple as the only crypto part of the new financial system? It's also part of the Fed Payment Task Force. Task Force. I'm not laughing at you, Mohit. I'm sorry. I'm just, whenever I hear the government use that ridiculous task force, just so stupid. It's task force. I don't even know what that is. It's just okay. I'm gonna go off on a tangent here. I'm gonna go off in a rant. So I apologize. Let me focus here. So I'm not sure exactly what that is, Mohit, and I'm just barely familiar with Bitcoin through my conversation with Andrew the other day. And as far as Ripple, I haven't gone into that as much. I know it's less decentralized, or it's more centralized. So I'm not sure that I have a good answer for you. And I don't want to just say something right off the top of my head to sound like I know the question well, or know an answer. So I'm going to have to punt on that one. And just please do look for my next interview with Andrew, because we'll definitely dive into that for sure. Okay, and shoot, my computer's running low here. Guys, let's see, we're on for an hour, 20 minutes. I don't think it's gonna last another 10 minutes. So, and I've got a bunch of super chats that I've gotta get to, wow. Okay, well, let's do this. Just bear with me one moment, guys. I'm going to have to plug in my computer, and that's going to mean I'm going to lose the microphone audio, but it'll go to the kind of the crappy audio of the computer. I think that's going to be our only way I'm going to be able to get through these super chats. So let me set this up here. Sound is fine. Yeah, we can hear you. Okay, great. Cool. All right. Awesome. Sorry about that, guys. Let me get back to the super chats. Okay, Nathan, thank you for the super chat, asks, any clarification on how soon to expect housing bubble 2.0 to pop? Wifey is pushing me to buy. And I'm nervous. And Oklahoma City market hurt in last bubble in Atlanta. Oh yeah, Atlanta really went down. Can buy it. Well, if you can buy it 140 to 160 per square foot there, Nathan, that's not horrible. I mean, that's going to be really close to the cost of construction. It's not ideal. It's not, but you already know that. So obviously you've got some factors outside of your control as far as family. So I don't like it. It's not ideal. But if you're buying at 140 to 160 a square foot, it's a hell of a lot better than buying in LA or New York or Seattle, Portland at who knows how, you know, 500, 600, whatever it is, a square foot there. So if I had to buy that, that would be the circumstance that I would buy. Yeah, I think I'm trying to think if I could give you any other advice on that, Nathan, but I think that's my best advice. Okay, Vince. Thank you for the super chat. Vince asks, your videos tell a story that the U.S. economy is on life support. How about buying a put option on the Dow Jones ETF dated January 1st, the strike 30% down at the current price? If you want to speculate on something like that, Vince, but I don't know that I'd do that until, because again, we want to make sure, guys, that we differentiate between the U.S. economy and the stock market. Because the stock market is completely driven on liquidity right now, 100% on liquidity. It's not driven on fundamentals whatsoever. So you can have an economy going down, really, and you could have a stock market going up. Even if we went into recession, you could still have the stock market going up if the Fed is printing enough money and pumping it into the system. Not likely, but it's possible. So I would go back to what I was saying earlier, and that I would wait for the Fed to reverse and start to go on a, not even a tightening cycle. I'd probably wait to until they started raising interest rates again. And once they did, then I might roll the dice on doing something like that. All right, Hector, thank you for the super chat. The next crash will happen when the Fed ends QE and low rate madness. Yeah. Probably. However, the government won't allow QT or higher rates. It would crash them. So is a melt up artificially? Okay, I'm thinking you're saying, so is the melt up basically endless? Well, it's not endless. That's for sure. Because at a certain point, the market's going to say we're done with these monetary shenanigans. But it could definitely continue. And also, I want to be clear that the market can go to infinity, and it doesn't mean that you're gaining purchasing power on your stock portfolio, because if the rate of inflation exceeds the rate of the Dow or the S&P going up, you're losing purchasing power, although the number associated to your stock portfolio can be increasing. Exactly. Just like Scott says, I'm looking at Scott right now. He says the stock market is great in Venezuela anomaly. That's the exact example I was going to use, Scott. Thank you for bringing that up. So his point is that, you know, if you've got stocks that are denominated in bolivars, sure, they're going to the moon. You've got a 1,000,000% increase, but those stocks don't have a lot less purchasing power than they did when they were 1,000,000% lower. Not that that's the exact number, but I think you guys get it. Dynamite asks, hi, George, if you had the opportunity to invest in either multifamily, single family home, both cash flowed within 1% RV ratio linear market, which would you prefer and why? So the first thing I want to do, Dynamite, is I did an interview with Jason that I have not yet posted where we discussed that specifically. So I'll probably be posting that maybe in a couple weeks. So stay tuned for that. We go over that extensively. But to answer your question, I prefer the single family. Why is that? Because you're going to get a better renter and you're going to have more liquidity. With a multifamily, I mean, you guys know that. If you've got a renter, you know the type of people that typically live in an apartment building as opposed or a even a triplex or fourplex compared to someone who has even rents their own home. It's a different type. And I don't want to, I know I'm generalizing quite a bit, but it's just a different type of renter. You're going to have a better quality renter, generally speaking, in a single family home. And then if you do go to sell it, remember, you've got two buyers. You've got an owner occupant and you've got an investor, where if you've got multifamily, you've only got the investor. That's it. So, and I think you can get some better lending terms generally with single family. So that's what I do for my portfolio. And that's what I suggest. That's when I help out family members, which I help out quite a few of them. That's exactly what I tell them to do. So that's exactly what I tell you guys to do. I basically give you guys the exact same advice that I apply to my own portfolio and I give to my family members. Matthew, thank you for the super chat. Macro Voices All-Stars episode 88 video there is a quote from Milton Friedman that low interest rates indicate tight monetary policy. Could you explain this? Because it contradicts traditional wisdom. So I remember hearing that. I need to go look at Milton Friedman's rationale. But if I were to speculate on his rationale right off the top of my head, I would say that low interest rates indicate tight monetary policy, right? So when the Fed is lowering interest rates, they're doing that in response to monetary policy being too tight. I don't know if he's saying that lowering interest rates tightens monetary policy. I think he's most likely saying that lower interest rates are an indication that monetary policy in and of itself was too tight. And now that said, I'm a massive fan of Friedman. I think he is awesome. In fact, I was watching some of his videos even this evening, trying to do some homework for next week. But he did put a little bit too much of an emphasis on money supply. And I think he overlooked a couple things that he, as an example, he thought velocity was consistent, which we know it's not. And so I don't want to get too far off track, but no one's perfect. Even the guys that I think are just awesome, like Friedman. But I'm thinking that's what he's implying by making that statement. Andy, thank you for super chat. In Australia, we are in the grip of some horrible stuff. Yeah, I know. Politically and economically, can you explain disaster capitalism and its effects? Disaster capitalism. I'm not sure what you mean by that exactly, Sandy. Are you maybe asking how capitalism, what we can expect maybe from capitalism in a disaster situation? And unfortunately, if history is any teacher, we can expect less capitalism in a disaster situation. Especially now with the central banks being so trigger happy with bailouts and liquidity and money printing. Going back to the financial crisis in the United States, that's a perfect example of that. They bailed out everybody, all the banks. Well, not all, but the TARP, all these massive bailouts. That is not capitalism. That is the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism is letting the banks go bust. That's like Milton Friedman says, one of the most or the most important part of capitalism is not necessarily the profit. It's the loss, that the reset. That you've got to allow the system to work. And if there's no such thing as a loss, that's not capitalism. No way. And that leads to all of the next round of malinvestment, bad decision making process, or bad decision making, and moral hazard. So if the banks think that they're going to get bailed out, then why not take exponentially more risk? And that's exactly what's happened. That's why the derivative market has gone through the roof. That's why debt, every single category of debt almost is at an all-time high. The moral hazard. So that's my point, is that if that's your question, Sandy, that's what you can expect. In a disaster, unfortunately, we can expect a lot less capitalism until it hits the fans so bad that, and what I mean by that is Venezuela. Like Venezuela, you think they want more socialism right now? No way. No way. Venezuela, they want more capital. They're crying for capitalism. They want private property rights. They want a solid currency. They want less government. They don't want any more of this nonsense intervention. So at a certain point, everything resets and it gets so bad that then, yeah, you do turn to capitalism. Unfortunately, in the interim, you get a lot less of it. Kevin, thank you for the super chat, asks, Germany officially entered recession. Yeah, I saw that. And Brexit isn't far away. Where do you see the Eurozone and the Euro headed? How does it affect the US and the dollar? Well, I don't know as much about the Eurozone, Kevin, as I do about the United States. But I can tell you that I don't like any developed economy right now. Every developed economy is pretty much in the same category as far as their problems. It's just to what degree do they have those problems? Problem number one being debt, just burdened with just massive amounts of debt. And as you know, the Eurozone has a ton of negative interest or negative yielding debt. I think Switzerland even has corporate debt in negative territory. That is not good. So regardless of what's going on with Brexit, I don't like anything there. Other than Croatia. Now, of course, to be clear, those areas that are kind of outside on the periphery, like Croatia and Montenegro, they're really not in that same category because they're just so isolated. Like Montenegro only has 600,000 people and the whole country tied too much to all the nonsense. But and they have a flat tax. There's a lot of great things about Montenegro. But I think that's my best answer is that I personally would not want to invest there. I would want to diversify out of the euro as much as I could. And that said, you can't complete if your expenses are in euros, you can't diversify out of it completely because then you're taking on too much currency risk. But as long as you're just setting up your portfolio in a way that's prudent, just going back to my three rules, I think that's the best you can do right there. And just a reminder, that third rule is to diversify your currency risk and your political risk. So being in the European zone, you know, maybe you can find some investments, a good rental property in Croatia or Montenegro or some area that you're familiar with. And you can do your own homework that's close, but not in the danger zone. John, thank you for the super chat, asks, I bought a silver and gold miner international stock, okay? Even though I'm down on my investment, I think I'll recover, okay? Why are these stocks so volatile? Why? Because they're terrible businesses. They're really, really bad businesses, John. And I think that's my best answer. But that's why you only want to buy them as a speculation. And that's why you only want the speculative part of your portfolio to be a much lower percentage. For me, my max is 10%. So if I'm rolling the dice on something like that, it's not going to affect my lifestyle one way or the other. I think the problem that people get into is they get so gung-ho on gold and they just go all in on junior miners and they just get their butt handed to them. Because, and then at a certain point, you just can't handle any more losses. You sell, and then you don't get to ride it back up when the market actually turns and does what you thought it was going to do in the first place. So you've got to, and especially in investing, you've got to stay in the game. That's rule number one. And so, but to your main question is why they're so volatile, because they're just terrible businesses and most of them go bust. Okay, Sebastian's telling me I should probably check the time. Okay. Oh, wow. Jeez, yeah. All right, I didn't realize I was going this long. All right, guys. I'm going to finish with the super chats. Don't do another super chat, guy. I see right lane. So just I'm going to answer that super chat from right lane. But guys, don't do any more super chats because I'm not going to have time to get to them. So Sebastian, let's put up right lane here. Okay, I got it. And that'll be the last. Okay, Geo Rob. Thanks, Geo Rob. Yeah, my buddy.
Thanks to you and your team's hard work on these incredible videos. These weekly Q&As are awesome. Thank you, George. Thank you, Gio, Rob. I appreciate it. It was great to have a conversation with you the other day. And I appreciate you tuning into the live streams and taking the time out of your schedule to watch the videos. I try to say that as much as I can in the comments, but for those of you who don't read the comments, whenever someone gives me a compliment, I always try to respond back with what we feel is, and I'm speaking for myself and the team, is that we appreciate you guys watching the videos and commenting just as much, if not more, than you guys appreciate us producing the videos. So I realize that you guys are taking time out of your schedule to actually go and watch a 15-minute video on some guy you don't even know that's in the middle of Colombia that's ranting on about some sort of economic theory on a dry erase board, and the lighting's not very good, and the audio is not very good, and so we all really appreciate that, and I just want to make sure that I verbally communicate that just as much as I try to communicate it on the comments. Question: okay, what's worse, the economy, politicians, or the loss of gravity? I'm assuming you're talking about in the financial markets. What's worse? Politicians. Because if it wasn't for the politicians, then we wouldn't have the other problems. So if it wasn't for the federal government being, if let me put it to you this way. If the federal government was the same size now, long run, that was 200 years ago, there wouldn't be any, we wouldn't have these asset bubbles. We wouldn't have the Fed. We wouldn't have any of these issues. So for me, it all starts with the politicians. Zach, how strong is propaganda? Should weed be legal? I think all drugs should be legal. I don't think just weed. I'm a hardcore libertarian when it comes to just personal freedom. And if you want to destroy your body with drugs, that should be your right. And this whole, and for the people outside of the United States, and I think, I don't know if this is your specific question, Zach, as far as propaganda around drugs, but it's very, very strong in the United States. And it's bizarre because I'm not going to say anyone who's traveled, but as someone who's traveled a lot and spends time in Colombia, this idea that if we legalized drugs in the United States, that we would all just be doomed. And the next thing you know, we'd have 50% homeless because we'd all be zombies walking around with needles hanging out of our arms, just doing coke lines. That is total nonsense. Why do I say that? Right here in Colombia, I don't know if it's legal or not, but you can buy anything, maybe not heroin, but you can buy cocaine, you can buy weed, you can buy, I mean, just walking down the street. I mean, it's, you can buy cocaine just as easy as you could just walk down to your local corner store and buy water. And the normal people, the responsible people, they don't do it because it's there, just because they can buy it, doesn't mean that they go do it every night. And it doesn't really have an effect. Now, the people that come down here, of course, generally gringos, just to party and that type of crowd, yeah, they're going to buy the coke. They're going to do the coke. But they're going to do coke back in the U.S. anyway, whether it's legal or not. So if you look at all the resources that the government allocates to, like, the war on drugs, and you look at the net effect, there's no benefit there. I don't think so. All right, right lane. And this will be the last super chat and last question, guys. Huge respect for the channel. Are you an ANCAP? So that would be an anarcho-capitalist. I don't know, right lane. I don't really think about it too much, to be honest with you. I don't know if I'm a libertarian. I don't know if I'm an ANCAP. I believe there's, to a certain degree, there's a role for a very, very limited role for government.
But I believe in personal freedom. I believe in personal responsibility, personal accountability. I believe in the government being a master or a slave, or the people being the master of the government, and not vice versa. And so I don't know where that puts me on the political spectrum, but I know, I mean, probably the most famous ANCAP I know is probably Doug Casey. And I would probably agree with 90% of what Doug Casey says. Now, that said, the most famous libertarian I know would be Ron Paul or like Tom Woods. And I agree with 90% of what they say. So I'm somewhere there. I'm not sure exactly, but I try not to put myself in a category. I just try to look at every issue independently and try to make a decision as to what I think is right or wrong using, I don't know if you want to use the non-aggression principle like the libertarians would say, but I definitely believe in private property rights and personal liberty. All right, guys, that is it. I appreciate you guys being on the live stream during the football game. I think tonight was a record. I think Sebastian will know, but maybe we got up to 750 people on the live stream. I apologize for the battery cutting out. We'll make sure that doesn't happen next week. But you guys, we'll see you on the video. I'll try to do the repo market Tuesday. And then lastly, if you guys just want to remind everyone about the podcast, if you're a podcast type of person, make sure you go to iTunes or your favorite place to subscribe. And you can listen to all the live streams there and the interviews that I do with the for the Rebel Capitalist Show. And next Friday, I'm interviewing Rick Rule. And I forgot to mention, this is for all 547 people that stayed on to the end. You get a bonus secret that I didn't tell anyone at the beginning. And that is, drumroll, please. This Wednesday, I'm interviewing none other than Luke Grohman. So we got the Brent Johnson interview. Everyone loved that. That guy's awesome. And through Brent was able to hook me up with Luke Grohman. And those of you who listen to Macro Voices and watch Real Vision, you're definitely going to know who Luke Grohman is. And for those of you who don't know who he is, you're going to have to watch this interview because he is amazing. And I can't wait for that interview this Wednesday. We'll probably upload that this weekend. So thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.